Nice. And now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, so please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Mike.
Thanks, everybody, for having me here. I apologize to Bill for coming in at the last minute. I told him I wouldn't do that. I swore on a stack of Bibles about that. I said, Bill, I'd never, ever make the guys nervous about showing up. He said, because I've arranged for speakers, you know, and they breeze in at the last minute. And by that time, you've selected another speaker in their place. And anyway, let me get this started again. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. Anyway, I do think it's a privilege to be here. I want to thank you for having me. This is the second time I've been here, actually, so it couldn't have been that bad last time. I'll just try to repeat performance. I've always said that there's only a couple of things you have to know to do this. One is always use the restroom. If you get selected to be a speaker, use the restroom before you go. There's nothing like a bathroom break in the middle of your pitch to just ruin the whole. No, it's true. No, really. Anyway. I've been around for a while, and I really love Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got around here, I was in a terrible mess. I was trying to kill myself, but I didn't bring the demonstration tonight. I went to a meeting one time and demonstrated how I was trying to kill myself. I brought my shotgun, and I went to show the group how I touched it off. It didn't go over big. I don't recommend props when you're trying to do this, so none of that tonight. I left the shotgun home, but I still have it. I remember being out there in my little shop and where I hid out and drank and hoping that nobody would discover me out there because, you know, I was way past the point of drinking for conviviality. I was drinking because I needed a drink and I'd sit out and get that old shotgun and I'd practice touching off the trigger with my toe with a barrel in my mouth. And to tell you the truth, I don't know how I didn't do it by accident. You know, I always had the bullets in it. And I'd put them in from time to time, make sure I knew how to load it, but I never did. Anyway, here I am. I guess back of my head's still intact. Anyway, to tell you how I got where I am now, I want to say a little bit about my childhood because I know I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous people have, you know, I guess some justification for how they turn out, but then they can blame some of it on their upbringing, you know, but that's not true of me. I came from nice people. They drank a lot, but they had fun drinking, you know. They partied and laughed and danced with each other, and I wanted so much to be part of that, and so I crowded a little bit, you know. As soon as I could get a fistful of something to drink, I started it out, but, you know, I was in love with it immediately. I know that if there had been such a thing as ADD when I was a kid, you know, I'd still be on Ritalin, because I had an awful time in school trying to, you know, to relax and do. I mean, I was smart enough. I got A's and B's, I think, but I was in a Catholic school, so they had two sides of the report card. You know, they had a side for academics, which was mathematics and reading, and I always did real well. I got lots of A's, and then another side, which was what? Conduct. I think it was performance in our school. Whatever. But you got the idea. It was like, you know, what kind of a social person are you? You know, and my report card read like one of a sociopath. You know, I got A in mathematics and D in gets along well with others. And so anyway, I had a tough time in school. I managed to graduate, and mostly because the nuns, you know, they would have taken it as personal not to let to get anybody out of school with a degree. So I did manage to graduate, and by the time I graduated, I'd found a way to have liquor on me all the time, and I wanted to be so much a part of what my dad and his brothers were doing, you know, and they because they always had fun with it, and that's all I wanted was in on that, you know, but they didn't like me drinking around with them at all, and it really set me apart immediately. And of course, it caused a lot of other problems. You know, a lot of people say, well, I drank normally for years and did just fine. That's not my story. Once I started drinking, I started having trouble and police trouble neighbor trouble. And, you know, what that boy's up to anyway, and destruction trouble and just trouble. I had lots of troubles like that. So by the time my poor mother, you know, I don't think she ever got so much as a parking ticket her whole life, but in my high school years, the police would bring me home from time to time. She was just humiliated, absolutely humiliated at that. In fact, I'll tell you, here's the truth. You know, when I left for the Navy, my mother said that it was the nicest Christmas present that any mother had ever had. and it's not because she didn't love me. She did love me. But she just had all she could take. You know, she was overwhelmed. And so anyway, I went into the Navy and spent 10 years in there. And I really liked the Navy. You know, they had a little shell kind of a thing where they took care of me. They fed me, and it was always a place to sleep. And they didn't get too mad at me. And if I got in trouble with the civilians, the shore patrol would come out and swoop me up and take me back. So I'm going to take care of this one, you know. And I never really got in any serious trouble until right at the end. The nice thing about the Navy is that, see, about every 3 years, they take you off to a place you've never been before, where you got all new people that don't know what an asshole you are, you know. So anyway, it worked out well for me. So, because by the time 3 years rolled around, most people had had it all they could take of me. So, in the final analysis, I got in trouble with them. They gave me just enough rope, and I cut it around my throat like that, and tried to I decided to get out of the Navy. Well, the last four striper that I talked to said, you know, what are your plans for the future? I said, well, I'm going to get out. And he said, well, I want you to do something for me. He said, why don't you go back to the barracks and get yourself a little glass of water like this. And he said, and stick your finger in it. He said, and yank it out real quick like that and look in there. And he said, that's how much we're going to miss you. So, yeah, like my mom, you know. So anyway. Anyway, I was married and had a couple of kids by then, so I thought, well, it was a good time to get out anyway. The kids were getting ready to go to school, and it was all going to work out just fine, you know. Once I got on my own and got them guys out of my neck, I was going to be just fine, but it wasn't fine, you know. By that time, I was way past drinking for fun. By that time, I was drinking because I needed to, and when I got into civilian life, I got to be honest with you guys, it was awful. I mean, I've never even had a checking account. Why, in the Navy, they pay you money, and you take the money and you give it to guys that you owe money, and then the rest of it you drink up. It's not a big deal. It's not complicated. There's really nothing to it. So, but in the civilian life, it's different. You know, there's the gas company, electric company, and the paper and the cable and the blah 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 blah. There's people you have to pay, and I never did get the knack of it. I'll be honest with you. And that poor little woman I was married to, just to take a second to comment on my admiration for her. You know, she stuck with me that whole way, and even 10 years into sobriety, we finally threw in the towel. You know, because it just wasn't going to make it, even with 10 years in AA. And I expected it to. I really did, but it didn't. So, anyway. But she obviously figured out that I wasn't going to be much of a provider. We moved down to L.A. and because there was lots of jobs in those days, and this was a long time ago. It was 1974 when I got out of the Navy, so I moved down, and I like I say, I had four or five jobs. And I got fired from some of them, and I quit some of them, but anyway, I was obvious that I wasn't going to make it very well down there, and they offered a bunch of money for our house, so I sold my house, and we moved up here. Moved out to Ivanhoe. Well, that's my kind of place. You know, there wasn't any law out there, and it had some just my kind of bars. You know, there's dirt floor things with 25-cent beer and maybe a shuffleboard table and a pool table. That's my kind of bar. So anyway, I fell in love with the place, but I don't think my little woman cared for it much. But anyway, she decided right away she was going to get herself a job, and she did. You know, so that made me a self-supporting alcoholic. You know, that's the definition of a self-supporting alcoholic, by the way, is one that's married to a woman who's got a job. So anyway, she got a good job. She was a nurse and took care of me. And I mean, otherwise, I would have died. Otherwise, I'd have died of starvation. starvation. One thing, but you know, I got sicker and sicker and sicker, and after a while, I got to where I didn't eat, and that's a real bad sign. If any of you have ever gotten there, I hope not. But when you get to where you drink more than you eat, that's bad. That's when your insides start to crumble and your organs start to eat themselves, and it's a real bad sign. And I remember I wasn't much of a God guy, and I learned everything I know about God I've learned here. But in those days, I had it figured out that I was an atheist, you know. I mean, that was that you're just born and you just live and then you die, and I was going to drink myself to death, and which is a long road, by the way. If anybody's trying that, I'd go with something else. That is a rough road, that drinking yourself to death. But anyway, she took care of us, and she provided a house and kept me in eat. So I remember waking up in the morning sometimes and praying after a fashion, or making this great plan anyway, that I was going to have something to eat that day, you know, a real meal with like a potato in it, you know, not one of those pig feet that they picked out of one of them big pickles. Ever eat that one? But nasty. Oh, God. You know, if you're in a nice bar, they use a pair of tongs. If not, they just pour it up. I don't know why that didn't kill me. I figure it this way. Look, I figure that Buddha or God or Allah or whoever it is in charge of taking people, they just got to not want me, because they've had a lot of opportunities to take me. I've never been really careful about living. I never figured on living anyway. I remember standing in the house at my 30th birthday and happy birthday to you. And I thought, man, I didn't think I'd ever live this long. You know, my wife said, well, me and the kids didn't either. So anyway, at the end, I started getting locked up too, and I started having trouble with the law. And I learned a lot of real serious lessons getting in trouble with the law. I learned that you don't refer to an officer's mother when you're being arrested. And this is a tip I'm throwing out there in case any of you guys got a relapse. If they get you, just put your hands behind your back and get in the car. Because I figured it this way: they ought to earn their pay. You know, if they want me in the back of that goddamn car, they're gonna have to put me in the back of that. That's the wrong road. Okay, just from personal experience, I'm telling you that if they tell you to get in the car, put your hands behind your back and get in the car. So, and I learned that over several experiences. So it's like I had a bullseye on my back. And at the end, every time I went to Visalia, I got arrested. But you know, they knew if I was out, I was messing up. And hell, the jailer knew me by my first name. He used to let me do my own fingerprints. Yeah, there's a claim to fame. Last days of my drinking went like this. Okay, I got a drunk driving, which wasn't a big deal, but they locked me up down there. And in those days, and that changed, I guess they don't do it anymore, but in those days, they used to keep you an hour for every point that you were drunk. In other words, if you was 0.08, they kept you for 8 hours, and if you 0.10, they kept you blah, blah, blah. That's the way it was supposed, scientifically, you were supposed to be sober when you got out if they did it that way. So I was in 26 hours, so I was pretty sick, and I hadn't eaten in days, and I'd been on this rough little drunk, and my poor woman, you know, it got so she really didn't ever, I mean, you just never know. If I walked out of the house at 3 o'clock in the afternoon going for a pack of cigarettes, I might not come back for 3 or 4 days. I did it all the time. It got so bad that she'd see me, and she'd say, oh, are you here? So anyway, this particular drunk, and I don't even know how I got the money to go on it, but it was a pretty good one, a little 5-day thing, when I got home, nobody was there, and I haven't discussed it with her. I don't know where she was. I think she went up to see her sister. But anyway, I did the drunk thing. You know, I pulled all the shades down, took the phone off the hook, and just I laid on the couch and watched Oprah and shit like that because I was sick, man. I mean, really sick. I mean, not even eating soup and crackers sick. I mean, sick. So anyway, a couple of days around like that, and I don't know. I think I got out on Monday morning, and from Saturday night, and anyway, Thursday, I'm thinking, you know, I'm feeling a little better, and You know, I know what would make me just go right into the zone. If I just had a couple of beers, you know, like just a six-pack of tall boys, I could feel really good. And then I got to thinking to myself, you know, what is it going to take for you, man? Are you going to have to kill a carload of innocent people for you to get the news on this drinking thing? So anyway, I started getting scared, you know, and real scared. People talk about fear being a bad thing. I don't know. Start with fear is, in some respects, a good thing. It's what keeps me from trying to do a double loop on a dirt bike, you know, because I can't do it, and if I try it, I'll break my neck. So anyway, fear is what happened to me. I just got afraid to keep on being like I was being. You know, my behavior had gotten insane. I'd become an impromptu disrober, spontaneous disrober. This is bad. I hope none of you have come. I hope there's no other person in this room that's come to that point in his intoxication. For some reason I felt obligated to take my clothes off in the weirdest places, and it was never a pretty sight. I shouldn't have mentioned that. It's probably worse than a shotgun, but anyway. Anyway, I made the decision that I needed to do something rather than drink that beer. And I didn't see any way out, really. I mean, I looked at the phone book, and they had all kinds of things in those days, and real nice places that a guy could go, real nice places, silk sheet places, they call them, you know. I bet you a couple of people remember it here. It was called the Peace and Serenity of the Kingsburg Hills. Anybody remember that? Yeah. Dad, we had this rummy house in Kingsburg. I guess it was a nice place. I don't know. But hell, it turned out it was like 40 grand or something. And listen, guys, there wasn't nobody in my life who was going to invest 40 grand on the chance that I'd go up here to Kingsburg and get right with the world. That wasn't going to happen. No, if I was going to get sober, it had to be for free. So that's how I ended up in AA. Here's the good news, okay? I called Central Office. In those days, Central Office used to refer drunks to people that would come over and see you. They'd make 12-step calls. I don't know how much we do that anymore. We get people from so many different avenues these days. We get them from hospitals and jails and rummy houses and I don't know how many people call Central Office looking for that kind of help. It may happen, but I don't get calls. I'm on the list, but I don't get those kind of calls much anymore. Anyway, I did call, and they hooked me up with this guy that was right there in town, and he knew me. I didn't know him, but he knew me. But you know what? That was probably the situation for a lot of people in Ivanhoe. You know, I had people joke all the time that I was the mayor of Ivanhoe because I was drunk all the time. I was downtown here in those two dive bars they had downtown. So probably a lot of people down there knew me, as the Ivanhoe wacko. But this guy said he knew me. And he come down. I went down to his place. Actually, went down to his house, and we talked for a few minutes in front of his wife. I don't remember that conversation, and I'm kind of glad of it, to be really honest with you, because that 5-day drunk hadn't 100% worn off yet. But anyway, he said, you know, if you could lay off the sauce till tomorrow, I'll take you to a meeting. So I don't know what the hell. I had 4 days into it, man. I was 4 days sober. Anyway, I thought, well, sure, why not? So I did. I didn't drink until the next day, and then. He hauled me off. We went down here to Lonico. It was right down the road here, actually, in those days. There's a little Mexican restaurant down here now, a real nice restaurant. But anyway, that's where the Alano Club was, and it is a rough spot in those days. And this was a Friday night, and the fifth chapter was in. Man, they all had these big knives hanging on. I mean, a rough-looking bunch, you know, and smoke about halfway down the middle of the room. You couldn't hardly see across the room. It was pretty wild deal. I'll tell you what, it's as shitty as any bar I'd ever been in. So I settled in there, and on the face of it, it's kind of rough, but what the hell? It's not like I'd come from church. I mean, I'd been in lots of rough places before. I had a whole different picture in my head of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm always glad that somebody didn't drag me down to an AA meeting before I was ready. I'm always glad of that. Real grateful for that. That when I saw you guys the first time, it was the first time. You know, I hadn't gone down there and made up my mind that, you know, that AA was a bunch of wackos and a bunch of crap that I didn't want anything to do with, because by this time, I was desperate enough to do about anything. So, I don't know. I remember a few things about that meeting, and I remember a few of the people that talked. I remember a guy that got up, a little old chicken of a guy, a little rooster of a guy, not much taller than me or at all. He's a truck driver. He said that he was I'm going to get it here in a minute. He was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And I thought, where in the hell did he get that? I've been thinking that about myself all my life, but I didn't think any... I thought you had to be nuts to be that. But he said he was that, and I knew I was that. So anyway, I kind of fell in love with it. The hook went in, enough at least to come the next day. The guy that picked me up, he's still my sponsor. I see, we're still good friends. But he had a job, which I didn't have. During this time, I didn't work at all. I had a little few things. I got used to work down here in town, but I got fired at that. So anyway, I didn't have in that 10 years that I lived in Ivanhoe, I didn't work at all. I bummed around. People would pay me in booze and cocaine. I like that too. I especially like cocaine payments. But anyway. I didn't work, and this guy had a job, so he couldn't baby me very much. I had to go on my own. Well, I still had a driver's license, or what was left of one. They didn't take your driver's license, and that's how long ago my drunk driving was. They didn't even take your driver's license. So, I was hooked. I went to AA all the time. I went all the time, and there wasn't anything else, any other way I could do it, because I didn't have any other restraints. I didn't have any friends that were in recovery. The people I was calling friends, they move in next door to your lawn dies. You know what I mean? These are so. Anyways, this was all new to me. But right away, I was able to figure out the similarities rather than the differences. I mean, if you look around here, you can always find something about your friend in AA that's different than you. You can say, well, this guy did it this way and that way, and he did this, and And if you're looking to do that, that's fine. Because we come from such diverse areas. People are wealthy, people come in, and poor people come in, and smart people come in, and dumb people come in, and so we're a very, very diverse group. But luckily, with the direction of these people, I was able to hang with the things about the group that I identified with. And I think that's huge. I think I was real lucky in that case. The luckiest thing that happened to me, guys, is this, is that I got hooked up with a group of people who loved being sober. They loved being sober. It wasn't just good for them. They were people that wouldn't drink if some miracle happened, and they could if they wanted to. They had all of the intoxication they wanted. And it had to be like that for me. If I'd have got hooked up with a bunch of people that thought it was okay to, maybe drink champagne at your daughter's wedding or smoke a little dope on New Year's, I wouldn't have made that. I wasn't the kind of guy that could have used one kind of intoxicant and throwed all the others out and stayed off of booze. The name of my tune. I never have pulled that off. And luckily, I got in with a bunch of people that felt like that. So anyway, I went to AA all the time, I didn't exactly do the steps at any kind of a rocket pace. Being an atheist, I had a hell of a time with that. And I asked my sponsor, I said, what am I going to do with this? This is how I really feel, that there isn't any God, And he says, well, I'll tell you what. He says, you'll be all right as long as you don't have to go down to them meetings and tell people that they don't have any God. You'll be all right. As long as you just can sit down there and listen to the experience that they've had about God, you'll be okay. And he was right. And here's how it happened to me. And as far as I'm concerned, dependence on a higher power is the number one gift that I've received here. Sobriety is wonderful, but the fact that I'm no longer alone in this. No matter what the situation is, I'm not alone. I have somebody I can depend on and a gigantic force that stands behind me. I'm careful not to ask too much, you know, because I try to remember that, you know what? I was getting exactly what I wanted when I came here. That's how I got in this mess, is I was having exactly what I wanted. Anyway, but here's how it happened. I went to this meeting one day over in Exeter. In those days, it was in the Catholic Church. They ran us out of there because we smoked too much. But anyways, kind of a nice little meeting about this size, and there was a lot of the heavies came in there, you know, of course, I was brand new, but anybody with 5 years was a heavy. But anyway, there was a lot of the big boys came around there. Fern Barber, you know, and I'm going to tell a Fern Barber story before I quit. But anyway, there was this guy there. His name was Jim, I believe, and he was he'd been a steel worker. Not Jim, Tom. It was Big Tom. Remember, he had these gigantic hands. Jim knows him. Had those gigantic hands, worked on the bridge up in San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge. Anyway, a real good guy and a real good alky. He always had something good to say. And I really looked up to him, you know. Anyway, he said that he had been in AA, been coming to AA for 25 years. And that he'd got a year here and a year there. And he said that the last time before he'd really gotten into it, he had 6 years, 6 years now. And he said that one day, he said he came to AA, but he never got a sponsor and he never did the steps or anything. Never got into it. He was just around AA and he wasn't drinking. So one day he went down to the barbershop. I'll never forget him telling this story. So he went down to the barbershop to get a haircut. He was a kind of the guy who wouldn't go anywhere else. It wasn't just, you know, that was his barber and that's where he was going to get his haircut. And he said it was about 20 guys waiting in line at that damn barbershop. And it made him so pissed that he went across the street to a bar and got drunk after 6 years of sobriety. By the time I heard him say that, I think I had 3 years. And I had a job. I was making a little money. I had a pickup that was all one color. And that old woman had taken the plastic sheets off the bed and let me up in there with her. So, if that's the way you had to do it, I'll tell you what happened to me. I went home that day and I got the book out and I did that third step, just like it says in here. I got down on my knees and that was the end of anyway, I'll tell you a Fern Barber story. And yeah, I'm sorry you guys can't meet Fern Barber. He was a monster alcoholic. And he came in and out of AA for 25 years. And he said he had a drawer full of 1 year chips. And you can look it up, you can Google this. He's the number one state champion drunk driver. He got 27 convictions in California. Convictions now. Sometimes he'd go with three and they'd drop two of them and so he was arrested more times than that, but he had 27 convictions. So yeah, Fern Barber. Real interesting guy. He got a drunk driver on a tractor one night. He was out here at Granny's Pub up there in Lemon Cove, and his foggier came out of the place. He's drunk again, and he come out and he was driving. He was driving his tractor. He just come from doing something in his field. Anyway, but it's so foggy you can't see across this room. See, so anyway, Fern gets up on the tractor's got no lights on it, of course. And he gets on there and he sees a car come by. And a car comes by, and so he just jumps out in behind his car and he's following along. And all of a sudden, the car slams on his brakes, and Fern just barely keeps from hitting him, and it's a highway patrol. So anyway, highway patrol gets out of there, and they all know him, you know. So anyway, they're going to lay the clamps on him, the officer said, "Get down off that tractor," and started screaming. And so when he did, his feet were wet, and he slipped off the clutch. And when he did, he eefed that tractor right up on that highway patrol car through the back window. He had to ride to jail. Within all that broken glass. Anyway, a great guy. And this is got the kind of heavies, people who had been there and back. And you know, one thing is, you get around people like that, you you think, oh, I got a great story. I did this and I did that. Nah. No, these guys were the real deal. And I mean, they saved my life. They held my hand through that. They got me some work and they got my life straightened around where it made it worth living. And I've been through the steps, of course. I don't think I'm through the steps. I don't feel like a person ever gets done with the steps. I don't think that's what the steps about. I mean, a lot of people say, well, the steps keep you sober. I don't believe that anyway. What I believe is that you don't do the steps to stay sober. You stay sober so you can do the steps. Because I'll tell you what, if you're drunk, there's no sense in doing the steps. Don't waste your energy. Put the book under the window to hold the window up, and that's... And don't waste your energy, because you can do the steps so your ass falls off. You're still drinking, it ain't any good. That's what I found out. So anyway, I'm going to quit. I'm supposed to give them 5 minutes, so I'm going to quit. And I really appreciate you guys letting me come and speak. I hope we get a chance to do it again. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Bill.